Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, PA, which, of course, if you've been listening or know Bridgeport, it is near Philadelphia and the birthplace of the country, as far as I'm concerned. And I've been talking with people all across this country about their reasons for running for office at different levels of government, from city council and borough council and parliamentary up to judge, state legislator, Congress, and other races as well. And what we found is that people have their own reasons for running, and that campaigns and politics and elections may be somewhat similar everywhere, but they're also different in every area of the country. And it's important to take every election seriously and hopefully get good candidates everywhere. Today, I'm excited to have my first guest from the state of Kentucky. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about the changes in Kentucky, what's happening there, and hopefully encouraging some people to run for office either in Kentucky or around there or anywhere else to listen to our guest today, Richard Becker, who ran for the state legislature there, and also state legislator Josie Raymond are here on the call. So thank you, Richard and Josie.
Thanks for having us.
That's the first time and hopefully only time I ask you both to speak at the same time, I promise. So let's start with Josie. You were actually the first one to respond to me about this. Both of you ran for office. Have you always been a political person in general, you think?
No. I didn't think I'd run for office until I decided to run for office. And it was, you know, a few things that led to it, right? My professional career, my personal passions, it got me to this point where I was just sort of desperate to make social change, right? I ran for office to end poverty in America, which, like, that makes people chuckle, and then I'm like, no, I'm completely serious. Mm-hmm. So I was working with high-poverty students in various capacities in various states, and finally I moved home, and we'll talk about where home is, but I'm here in Louisville, Kentucky. And was looking for a way to sort of deepen my impact, right? And looked around and thought, I think that there's an opening here for leadership that I can bring on this issue and to this district.
And like you said, I imagine you've gotten people who've laughed at you for saying you wanted to end poverty, but shouldn't politics be aspirational?
Yeah. And we know so many things that would help do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we could cut child poverty in half in Kentucky if we really wanted to. And so, you know, I'm not joking when I say that's why I'm in this and that's the work that we're doing.
You know, I've talked to so many people in politics, and poverty doesn't come up enough. And I don't know why. I guess maybe because poor people don't vote enough, or people in the media talk about poverty more in terms of race and in terms of Trump than they do about actual poverty. Is that how you get the sense too there?
Yeah, I think it can just feel so big mm-hmm. to people, and it is really big. You know, when we've got 25% of our kids in Kentucky are living in poverty, 12% are living in extreme poverty, and so that can feel insurmountable, right? So I think it can make people feel better to, you know, focus on how do we grow daycare subsidies just a little, or how do we increase SNAP benefits just a little, instead of talking about things like living wages and free childcare and healthcare for all, real structural changes that are going to actually reduce that poverty rate.
And you say that 25% are living in poverty, but that doesn't mean that 75% of the state is doing great. It means that there are a lot of people who are on the bubble in some way, shape, or form as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I talk about my personal experience. So I was a free lunch kid growing up and then a Pell Grant kid in college, but like so many families, we had good years and we had bad years, right? Based
right.
on what my parents were going through and what was happening in our community. And there's so many families that straddle that line and go back and forth. And so it doesn't mean that everyone is comfortable and has the sort of choices that we would want for them, even if they don't show up in these poverty tables we see.
Now, Richard, I see that you've done some union organizing work. You worked with SEIU, right?
Currently, yes, I do.
And guess who else worked at SEIU?
I understand Tony Heil did.
I did! So we have a lot going for us. So you know the struggle of workers, and it sounds from, you know, the Democratic Party in different states is all different, but it sounds like at its core, there's a lot of people looking at after the working class that is under the underbelly of some of that party in Kentucky, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's correct.
And so tell me what, so if you, because if you're a union organizer, politics is in every breath you're taking.
That's right.
Have you been doing the work for a long time?
Yeah, so I actually, I had my first job in politics a little over a decade now. I was a field organizer for the Obama campaign in Ohio, Southern Ohio in 2008. And went back and finished my degree at the University of Kentucky, had a handful of jobs, you know, doing field organizing work with the Democratic Party. But like many people of my generation after the 2010 Republican wave, that was sort of, that was the last time I worked professionally in politics. I left that a little disillusioned about electoral politics, but wanted to put the skills that I had learned doing that field organizing work to bear on something else, and it seemed logical to me to try my hand at union organizing. What no one told me at the time is that you generally don't just sort of walk in the door to do union organizing, but I didn't know that, so I just applied anywhere and everywhere I could and landed a job here in Louisville working for AFSCME, that's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I worked there for a few years and then moved on to SEIU about 5 years ago. And obviously throughout the entire, I guess, almost 9 years now that I've been working in the labor movement, politics has been an undercurrent of everything I do, even if I wasn't doing explicitly political work. You know, I came into union organizing right around the time that former, thankfully, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker launched his attacks on working folks and their unions. And so it's sort of been, from the start, sort of a state of crisis every day. And that crisis has been created by ideologically driven right-wing Republican office holders who, state by state, are following you know, a carbon copy playbook that has at its core destroying the many protections that have been created over the decades to protect working families.
So, you know, you and I, we both have somewhat of a labor background. Did you know about those issues before you were so enmeshed in it, or was working in the labor movement really an eye-opening experience for that?
It was an eye-opening experience for me coming into the work. I mean, I had a general idea about what the issues were, but again, like many other people in my generation, you know, unions have not been as much an institution for my peer group as for, say, my parents or even more so my grandparents. You know, union density has been dropping dramatically over the past 50, 60 years. And so, you know, growing up, neither of my parents were in a union. My grandmother was a member of the United Auto Workers. And so I, you know, heard about her experiences in the union. And from working in politics, I interacted with union members, of course. I mean, a good third of the folks who came out to knock doors when I worked in Southern Ohio were labor folks. So I'd seen, you know, seen labor unions from those perspectives, but I didn't realize how deep some of these issues went until getting into the work. And a side effect of that was seeing how the Democratic Party, Republican Party, you know, dichotomy wasn't as clear-cut as I might have thought before I started doing the work. There were Democratic elected officials who we were having to tussle with, you know, sometimes almost as much as Republicans. Republicans wanted to destroy us, but some of these Democrats were, you know, only a little bit better. They let us continue to exist, but weren't going to give working folks any of the tools that they were asking for to grow their power in our economy. And so it has been a really eye-opening experience and continues to be every single day.
So it sounds like both of you are approaching politics, especially in Kentucky, and trying to lift up people, excuse me, and especially to improve the economic condition, especially where there's high poverty issues, where there's lack of opportunity, lack of respect for workers. And so, Josie, you ran for office. Was this a top priority for you? I saw that you had a lot of union endorsements when running and getting involved. Is that what got people behind your campaign?
Yeah. So this has been my message the whole time. I really frame it as strengthening families, right? Mm-hmm. And just like I said, we know ways to cut child poverty, for instance. We know ways to build secure middle-class families. And I would say the greatest is through collective bargaining and organized labor, right? So when I talk about strengthening families, the things I would talk about on the campaign trail were wages, healthcare, and education, which, I mean, sounds cliche. Any candidate could put that on any flyer, right? But when we dig into it in Kentucky, we see stagnant wages and a tax on organized labor. Our previous governor, who's on his way out, Governor Matt Bevin, was threatening to cut or undermine Medicaid expansion, which covers 400,000 people in Kentucky. So I talked about how we can protect that and eventually expand healthcare to everybody. And then on the education piece, we have seen public education in Kentucky. We've seen a push for privatization, and we've seen demonization. And so defending our districts, our educators, and our children has been a big part of my campaign and my time in office. And then my top legislative priority has been pre-K for all. So I believe that the state of Kentucky can and should provide full-day, high-quality, publicly funded pre-K to all of our 3- and 4-year-olds. It's the silverest bullet that we've got to attack some of these issues of generational poverty.
It's something that's very important to me. My son is in kindergarten now, and my other one's in daycare. We can afford his daycare. My son is in a public kindergarten, which is great. And I know that there's people who live not far from me who aren't in good schools or are struggling, not because the school's bad, but because of the situation there. I have two questions for you, Joseph. I'll ask the first one first. What would the impact be by improving those educational standards and opportunities, especially to parents and families with young kids? Like, what would that mean for Kentucky?
Yeah, well, we're living the same life. I've got a public school kindergartner and a child in daycare, and then we've got our third baby coming.
Oh, good for you. Good luck to that.
So you have seen the incredible impact of pre-K on children. You know, in Kentucky, we don't mandate school attendance until age 6. But anybody who knows a child knows that there's incredible learning happening every day from birth to 6. But then your family has also felt the pain, right, of paying for high-quality childcare.
It costs more than our mortgage.
More than your mortgage? Yeah. Oh, same here.
And it's not – and we don't have the most expensive, like – not to get off – well, it's on topic. But I remember another babysitter, someone who was at a daycare at a gym I took my kid to. She's like, oh, your son should come to our school. He's really smart. I'm like, but that school's another $1,000 a month, and he's obviously doing well in your mind. So, no.
Right. It's an impossible decision for families. And so when I start these conversations with organizations, stakeholders, legislators about pre-K, they start with the children, right? Do we think that we have a moral imperative to provide these sorts of opportunities for children? We know it would increase our kindergarten readiness rates. You know, nobody's arguing with the brain science that shows how important it is for children to learn through play, you know, at ages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But then I try and expand the conversation and say, what would this do for families, right? Not just low-income families who would be able to go to school, go to training, go to work all of a sudden, but what would it do for middle-class families who right now are not paying their student loans, who are not saving for retirement, who are not fixing their homes? Then we talk about early childhood educators. They're almost all women, and they're almost all underpaid.
Right.
The average wage for our child care workers in Kentucky is $11 an hour. So, you know, you hear stories about, like a Wendy's opens up next to the daycare in a certain county, and it pays more. And so the employees move, and the daycare shuts down. And then finally, we talk about the benefits to the economy, right? So there would be immediate benefits in terms of attracting employers and employees to Kentucky because we were providing the sort of wraparound support that we know people need. But then also, this is how we instill in kids the soft skills that our employers are demanding, right? In Frankfurt, our capital, we hear all the time that employers can't find people with these soft skills, right? They can't find people who, like, take turns and, like, express their feelings in words. And so I say, well, where do people learn to do that? And it's in pre-K.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want our economy and our workforce to be strong in 10, 20, and 30 years, this is where we start.
So for you, Josie, and then roundabout to Brad after that, I mean, Richard after that, sorry, I talked to someone named Brad earlier. What's the pushback? When people, is it ideological? Is it power? When you see as a legislator that X works, why don't you do X?
Yes, and it can be very frustrating. The pushback, there are complaints at the margins about big government and, you know, forcing children into school too early. And so then we do education around this is not babysitting and this is not children chained to desks, right? We try and show what excellent pre-K really looks like. But the big complaint is really we can't afford it. And we do have a really tight budget here in Kentucky, but I think that the majority party in our capital is using our budget constraints as an excuse, right? They're saying, well, there's only so much pie, and we're trapped in this box. And I'm saying, well, there's ways to expand this pie and open up this box in terms of revenue. So it's the price tag, and it's a big price tag. You know, it will cost hundreds of millions of dollars to provide pre-K to all of our kids in Kentucky. But, you know, we've got decades of research showing that the return on investment is huge. If you'll give it 10 or 15 years, we'll see it pay off in terms of the economy, lower incarceration rates, higher lifetime earnings, you know, everything you can think of.
So, Richard, that's to you, too. You've done union organizing now. You've worked with trying to promote issues. What do you see as the pushback on some of these economic issues? Is it just ideological? Is it like they feel like they can't because of who they have to, the Republicans or other Democrats even have to kowtow to? Or do people really believe that they shouldn't make these investments?
I think it's, as you might have anticipated my answer, a little of all of the above. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when I made reference to, you know, certain Democratic elected officials, you know, around the country that are sometimes, you know, tussling with labor almost as much as their Republican counterparts, you know, I think of Ralph Northam, governor of Virginia, who now has the Democratic legislature and has said there will not be any action on repealing that state's right to work law. That really puts him on you know, a huge key issue to working families on the same side as his counterparts on the other side of the aisle. And I think that comes from, in that case, a desire to prioritize other issues and not wanting to distract from the push on those issues by pushing for something that in this case is probably seen as some sort of a niche issue, not a broadly, widely felt issue. But that is sort of a, you know, something that I would say organized labor could have done a better job of in the past half century and continues to need to do a better job of, which is articulating how the issues that we're pushing on really are issues that impact more than just, you know, the unfortunately small number of folks nationwide who are members of labor unions. So, you know, we know that in right-to-work states, workplace injury rates are higher. The rate of insured people is lower. Average wages for both union and non-union workers are lower. But we've allowed the other side to sort of message around this issue in particular and others as this being, you know, something that unions who are, you know, they're a small, you know, special interest group are pushing for. These are issues that affect everybody. And, you know, it's no mistake that, you know, here in Kentucky, some of the highest paid, you know, non-teacher school staff are in Jefferson County, which has allowed for 40 years now, it's its employees to collectively bargain with the district. Workers have been able to come together and push collectively for better wages and benefits and working conditions. It's not just a coincidence that here in Jefferson County and Louisville, those types of workers are better off. But until we can sort of shift the public mind around these issues and do a better job of countering the messaging coming from the other side, I think there's going to continue to be a struggle to push back on and hopefully eventually gain ground on these issues.
Yeah, so this brings me to something I like to talk about on the podcast, are the challenges. We're trying to encourage people to run for office, and for a lot of people who look at Kentucky, especially if you're looking at it from far away, they see it as unwinnable for a Democrat or a progressive to win there. Obviously not, given this year's elections with the governor's race, but that Kentucky's not alone in that respect. There's Kansas, there's Wyoming, there's the Dakota, all these states. So I feel like there's a lot of hesitance by decent people who be decent candidates to take up the challenge of running. So for you, Richard, first, do you see there being a challenge at getting working people engaged in Kentucky when they see there's not advancement on these issues? And then, Josie, after that, I'll ask you about the challenges that you see as someone in the minority party to get some of these done. So, Richard, first, do you see that as a challenge at engaging and motivating people to vote and get involved?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I mean, this is in one of many areas where the electoral political part of my life and career intersects with my day job, which is, you know, when we're organizing workers into the union, which is sort of my primary role in the union as an organizer, it's always amazing to newer organizers the challenges that we face in sort of having those initial conversations with workers in their workplace about forming a union, because they say, you know, these folks are paid, you know, $10 an hour, and their health insurance premiums are more than they make a month, and, you know, their working conditions are terrible, and they can barely support their families. Why don't they want a union? And my answer to that is always, you know, we have a society and a culture that does not give people a lot of hope in their own capacity collectively with one another to affect change, either in their workplace or in their political system. So the cynicism that gets talked about in the news media all the time around politics also applies in the workplace. And, you know, one of the things that I, you know, felt like I brought to the campaign and running for office as a union organizer was that perspective that there are ways to show people their own capacity, their own power, and to empower people that we, know in the labor movement from organizing work that can be applied to the political world. But I wanted to just hit on something real quick that you kind of alluded to, which is, you know, is it hopeless in a state like Kentucky, or you mentioned the Dakotas, and I would even throw in your state of Pennsylvania, which has large pockets of very conservative, areas. I think that, and I know I'm not the first to say this, but I think voters, like anyone in any sphere of their life, want authenticity. I can tell you from having knocked on doors for her campaign and seeing her on the campaign trail that Josie exudes authenticity to the folks that she talks to. They know that they're talking to a real human being and not, a typical politician. I tried to bring that to my race, and I think that Andy Beshear managed to bring that to his race for governor. Our congressman here, John Yarmuth, is kind of known for being kind of blunt, but honest and authentic politician. He's very progressive, and he's in a district that, while Democratic, has a lot of, Republican-leaning precincts. There are a lot of Republican voters in the 3rd Congressional District, but those folks are willing to cast their ballot for him and have for, term after term after term, because he follows the maxim of, you're not always going to like where I stand, but you're always going to know where I stand. People can smell authenticity and they can smell inauthenticity, and I think that can overcome even ideological barriers.
Yeah, Josie, I assume that you saw that firsthand, since that's what Richard was saying about your campaign, that being authentic makes a difference. But to that, what do you see as the big challenges, both for engaging voters and for enacting some of these changes you want to make in Frankfurt?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Richard, for those kind words. I would joke to people that I got elected and I still didn't know how much this job paid, state representative in Kentucky, mm-hmm. right? And so that was, I was like, well, I guess I ran for the right reasons because I didn't even look it up. So it's, you know, you got to know where you are. So we're in Louisville, Kentucky, which is, you know, people call it this, you know, its own state or the blue dot in the Red Sea of Kentucky. But here in Louisville, in 2018, we saw 5 new Democratic women elected just in the city of Louisville to the state legislature. So so that was huge for us. And, you know, and those women are bringing new and more progressive voices. But what I want to tell people who are thinking about running who feel like it might be hopeless is that if you spend 10 hours with the data, you know, who votes in your district, who votes in presidential years, who votes in midterms, right? Who votes in off years, and where do they live, and who runs, and how many votes do they get, and where do they get their money? If you spend a few hours with that data, you know your race better than anyone on earth, including the incumbent.
Right.
And then something that I had to grapple with and come to terms with before I decided to run was that a lot of good could come out of losing, mm-hmm. and that I would survive losing. You know, I would meet people, I would elevate issues like pre-K, you know, I would build skills, I might get a better job, and then the hundreds or the thousands of people who did vote for me would feel seen and heard in a way that they hadn't in a really long time, and that would be inviting them to engage further. And then one of those people could run the next time. And so that, I think, is the slow build that we're working on in terms of engagement, but it just starts with those authentic conversations and saying, I'm willing to do this because of, you know, I believe we can have a stronger community. Will you join me? You're not alone in building it person by person.
You know, you were talking about inspiring other people that maybe the next person would run. Thankfully, it's you. But, yeah, I saw an article this week about how when a woman was running for Congress, it boosted up the feelings of other young women in the area that they could do it too, by especially Democratic women. So it seems so important in this last election, in 2018, that women were running and winning. And my state of Pennsylvania went from having 0 women in Congress out of, I don't remember how many, like 18 Congress members, to now having 4, and we almost had more. But we still, only one state in the country has majority female legislature. So, Josie, do you see what it means to have more women in office and running for office? And do you see what kind of power could come from having many more women up and down the ballot?
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got the data on it, right? You'll see a study every few months that say women make better decisions or women get more done in office. And I think even men are not surprised by that, right? But you can feel a difference in the hallways of the Capitol in Frankfurt now that we've got more women. We've got a record number of women in the Kentucky State House. It's 27 out of 100. And so we gave that a standing ovation in Frankfurt this year, and I was looking around like, really? We're giving that a standing ovation?
Right.
But, you know, it does bring a different tone, right? There's, you know, we don't want to be pigeonholed to sort of only focus on women's issues, because women's issues are human issues, of course, but there is more discussion about childcare and child rearing and public education and public health. And so these are concerns that women in particular elevate, and we've already seen that in Kentucky just this year.
And, you know, Richard, Josie was talking about a lot of these jobs, especially in education, because you don't have to talk about these issues in, separately. They're all connected, especially healthcare, education, and the economy. But as a union organizer, and especially as an SEIU organizer, you see the power of elevating women in the workforce, and you know, making sure working women get the power that and respect that they deserve, right?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, the folks that we work with the most, you know, particularly, I mean, we're called Service Employees International Union for a reason, and it's because we're predominantly organizing lower wage service workers. So, fast food workers with the Fight for 15 campaign, but home care workers, healthcare workers, nurses, and other folks in hospitals and nursing homes, and you know, folks who work for contractors and airports doing janitorial work or food service work. And these are jobs that are predominantly held by women, and among those women, predominantly women of color. And to see, I mean, to talk, get back to the comment I made earlier about how folks don't really have a sort of built-in notion of their own power, you see a certain power that comes from being able to do this type of work in the types of conditions that they have to. And if you can connect that to the notion of being able to build power for themselves, it's a truly incredible thing, and it changes families, it changes communities. It changes, you know, everything in their workplace. And so, you know, Josie referred to collective bargaining, organized labor as one of the strongest and most reliable paths to building secure middle-class families. And it's true. And you, I'm sure in your work for the union, Tony, have seen it. I see it every day when organizing unorganized workers into the movement.
Right. So one thing that did happen this year is Kentucky had a big change. So what do you see about the hopes and things that people should know about the politics of Kentucky? Richard, since you just finished, why don't you go and just, you know, are you feeling hopeful about Kentucky? What should people outside there know about the politics right now?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, because as Josie, I'm sure, can attest as well, there have been countless hot takes from the national press about what this election means nationally, and sort of for Trump and the impeachment hearings and all of this stuff. And I would urge folks to check out, there was an editorial in the New York Times this week co-authored by our governor-elect Andy Beshear and recently re-elected Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, talking about how they, as Democrats, were able to win in otherwise politically Republican states. You know, I'm a detractor from the notion that this election in Kentucky had a whole heck of a lot to do with Trump or impeachment, and had more to do with the fact that Matt Bevin spent the last 4 years openly, unabashedly, gleefully attacking constituent group after constituent group, including teachers and other public employees who, in some Kentucky counties, are, if not a majority, a plurality employer, public sector is. And so this guy had made political enemies of even Republicans, right? I mean, he notoriously was feuding with his own Republican-controlled state legislature for the past several years because of his behavior. So I would, while I think there are lessons to draw from this, and again, I would urge folks to check out Beshear and Edwards' editorial this week, I would urge caution in saying that this has a ton to do with Trump, and in fact has to do with people not liking that Matt Bevin was just a colossal jerk for the past 4 years. But I'm hopeful. I mean, I had a friend that texted me the night of the election who was, you know, a Beshear supporter, voted for Beshear, but wasn't real excited about the campaign. He texted me and said, are we supposed to be excited? And we've talked since then, and I say that yes, because, you know, if we take Beshear's, you know, promises on the campaign trail to heart, in his taking office, we're going to see, I hope, you know, many thousands of disenfranchised former felons given their right to vote back. We're going to see, you know, a new state board of education. We're going to see attacks on teachers and other public employees come to an end. We're going to see Again, if he does as he said he would on the campaign trail, we're going to see finally some raises for teachers and other school employees. There are countless ways that his election are going to be good for this state, reversing some of the most onerous things that Bevin did. And so I think there's reason for hope, and I think that as Beshear is able to make progress on some of those issues, that we're going to see more and more people, hopeful about the future of Kentucky again after four very dark years politically.
Yeah, Josie, we can't just all hope that Republicans only nominate terrible people like Matt Bevin, though they do have a history of doing that lately. So what are you hopeful for, and what should people know about what is possible or what might not be great about the state of Kentucky, too?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited and hopeful.
Good.
That over the next 4 years, Kentuckians are going to have a better life.
Great.
And Richard alluded to it, but our new governor-elect, Andy Beshear, said he's going to do three things on his first day. Restructure the Board of Education, right, to protect and elevate public education. Public educators are the grand marshals of his inaugural parade in 2 weeks, which says a lot. He's going to restore voting rights to tens of thousands of people convicted of felonies, right, which is going to change the face of the electorate in Kentucky. So when we're talking about, what do elections look like in 5 and 10 years, they could look quite different, right, because we're going to have more people voting. 1 in 4 black men in Kentucky can't vote right now, have lost their right to vote, and will regain it. And then lastly, he's going to protect Medicaid expansion in Kentucky, which I mentioned covers 400,000 people. So those are very concrete things that are happening on the first day. So, Richard, I don't know if you saw it yet. There was an article in today's newspaper, our Courier Journal, about which Republicans will run for governor in 2023. And, of course, it's too early to be talking about that. And they had pundits saying the Republican will absolutely win in 2023. And I said, I don't know, because people are going to feel better about the state of Kentucky. It'll be easier, hopefully, to go to the doctor and send your child to school and earn a paycheck that makes your family feel comfortable and secure. And so then we're getting rid of the party label, the political piece of it, right? And it's like, how has this policy affected your family?
Yeah, and I think you both point out, and one of you've seen it in different perspectives, that part of the reason people should run is because government can be very powerful, whether for bad, for what Matt Bevin had done, or for good, for the things you're trying to get done. Right, Josie?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I want to share this piece of advice that I got when I was thinking about running that always stuck with me, and it may stick with someone out there. But if you've got the passion and the work ethic, you can run the best campaign your district's ever seen. And that's a lofty thing to say, but most politicians and most campaigns are still sort of old school and slow to adapt. And, and the electorate is changing every day. And if you're willing to be authentic and bring your passion to the campaign trail, you can run the best campaign your district has ever seen.
Right. So last question, because we're getting into time here. Richard, first, why should more people run for office, even in very red states like Kentucky?
Because, if good people don't run for office, then we only have bad people running for office, which sounds glib and sounds simple. But the reality is so many races at the local and state legislative level in places like Kentucky go completely uncontested.
Right.
A Republican just wins over and over again without having to do any work, even as their electorate is changing. We get these, ideas in our head, that's a Republican district. Well, some of these districts are becoming less and less Republican. Lexington, for instance, just up the road from Louisville here in Kentucky, has a number of districts that either flipped in 2018 from Republican to Democrat or came close to. And these are districts that had long been written off as unwinnable districts, but they're changing. Demographics are changing, not just at the national level, but in places like Kentucky. And it was because certain people were willing to step up and willing to do it that we were able to flip or come close to flipping those seats. If they hadn't run, it would have been just another Republican, conservative Republican winning re-election without having to do the hard work of talking to actual voters in their district. So, you know, I really think it boils down to if good folks don't run, then we're only going to continue having more of the same. And I would just say to those that are possibly considering running for office and are worried that they can't do it successfully or even pull off a good campaign, I would point to campaigns like mine and Josie's in particular, where a first-time, you know, candidate was able to, in my case, I think, make a good showing and run a good campaign. In Josie's case, when in the early stages, if I may say so, Josie, a lot of folks didn't really know if it was going to be winnable for mm-hmm. your campaign. And so I would encourage folks to try it out, to give it a shot, because first-time candidates are winning. And there are more tools available to first-time candidates these days than ever before. Run for Something is a great organization that published a book by the same name that has a lot of nuts and bolts, really practical advice for running for office. Emerge is a national organization that has a Kentucky chapter that encourages Democratic women to run for office and trains them on the skills they need to do that. And so having the tools and resources and skills to run for office shouldn't be a barrier to first-time candidates, and I'd encourage them to seriously explore the possibility, given all of the resources that are available. Because if they don't, someone else will, and that other person may not represent your interests or the interests of that district.
Totally agree. So, Josie, same question. It's called the You Should Run podcast. Why should more people listening run for office in 2020 or beyond?
We know that our challenges are great, right? Everywhere. Louisville, Kentucky, where you are, everywhere. And we need you, and your neighbors need you. You know, running and then win or lose, there's very little downside. There's infinite upside, right? Even if it's sort of an exercise in self-actualization, right? This is something you feel called to do. You should run because you can do it, and you can do it really well. And like Richard said, there are very few people who have the bravery and the boldness to do it. And wherever you run, whatever you run for, you will get hundreds and thousands of votes from neighbors who agree with you and didn't know that someone would run who did agree with them. And all of a sudden, they see themselves represented. And then after the election, that doesn't disappear. That only builds, right? So you should run because we need you and your neighbors need you.
Well, if you're listening, there's a good chance that your neighbors need you. You may have a perspective to bring to office, and that's missing from your state legislature, from Congress, from your school board, from your city council, from your county commissioners, whatever it is. So I hope you learned a good lesson from Richard Becker and Josie Raymond. Kentucky's got a lot going for it, and it's only going to get better if more people like them take up the challenge in running. Thank you, Richard and Josie, for joining me today, and I hope you guys have a great holiday season.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.